really it boils down to just simple community policing. Just being in the community, getting to know the kids, letting the kids get to know us.
A federal initiative to combat alcohol abuse in villages. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 14th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a 5,000-mile expedition through some of the most remote wilderness in Alaska and Canada.
650 miles took me 3.5 weeks, and I didn't see another human being the entire time and never crossed a road.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. And you can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
The U.S. Marshal's Office has stepped forward to help Western Alaska combat crime that keeps local officers too busy to get ahead. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes reports.
James Holscher has been doing law enforcement in the Bering Sea village of Hooper Bay for decades. He's been a village police officer, the chief of police, and now a village public safety officer. He was also born and raised there. He says he knows where the crime often starts.
I'm very familiar with the alcohol problems here in Hooper Bay.
Like many other communities in Western Alaska, those problems include high rates of bootlegging, sexual assault, and suicide. There have been times when there were enough experienced local law enforcement to help prevent these problems. But for many years now, Holscher says they've suffered from being stretched thin and can often only respond to the crime after it's been committed.
We became a reactive police department because we're short-staffed and we have many new hire police officers.
Holscher welcomed help recently from the Alaska State Troopers and Deputy U.S. Marshals when they showed up in Hooper Bay. They spent a few days in the village where they contacted 13 people that were suspected of bootlegging. That resulted in 3 arrests and 21 gallons of homebrew being seized. The visit is part of a new initiative that puts the local law enforcement, troopers, and deputy marshals working together to combat alcohol. It started just a few weeks ago as a pilot project in Hooper Bay. They also visited 5 communities on the lower Yukon River, where they contacted 50 people there. That resulted in 5 more arrests.
So far, it's been very successful, I think. It's accomplished what we wanted it to accomplish.
Captain Keith Mallard is the commander over the Alaska Bureau of Alcohol and Drug Enforcement, or the ABADE unit.
We're going to go use that as kind of the launching point, trial and error, what was good, what was bad, and expand it to all of Western Alaska.
Mallard says by pooling their resources together, they hope to have quick responses to residents who are asking for help.
One of the major ideas behind this initiative is to empower those individuals that have come forward and said, you know, enough is enough. And we're tired of, you know, our teenagers and our younger kids getting drunk and getting high, and we want to take a step to kind of do something about it.
Really, it boils down to just simple community policing.
Mark Ott is the chief deputy marshal in Anchorage. He says increasing their presence in the villages will hopefully allow them to enter into prevention-type enforcement.
Just being in the community, getting to know the kids, letting the kids get to know us, and it's really not much different than what we do here, going in and talking to the schools. Chatting with them about careers, chatting with them about life choices and how the decisions they make as youngsters affect their opportunities later on. And we're taking that out there.
He says the new initiative all came about because the Marshals Service was responsible for the Adam Walsh Act, which requires sex offenders to be registered throughout the country. While they were working on registering offenders in Western Alaska, they saw a way that they could assist the troopers. He says they plan to have 2 deputy marshals spending a week or two every month in the region. And eventually, if it works out, they'd like to bring the new project to other parts of rural Alaska. Captain Steve Arlo oversees the trooper detachment for Western Alaska. He says the initiative is what the governor's office, the attorney general's office, and the commissioner of public safety all want.
Some additional effort put into Western Alaska to fight domestic violence, sexual assault, sexual abuse, and all these type of crimes have a very close relationship with alcohol, the abuse of alcohol, and we can pretty much determine that majority of all these cases have some form of alcohol associated with them.
Back in Hooper Bay, Holscher has heard positive feedback from the community about the alcohol sweep at the beginning of the month.
Nothing but positive things. People are excited. They're happy that the Alaska State Troopers, the U.S. Marshals, the Hooper Bay Police Department, the Hooper Bay VPSOs are going to be targeting these problems head on. And, you know, making the people who are doing these things accountable for what they're doing.
In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning-Barnes.
Senator Lisa Murkowski plans to announce on Friday whether or not she'll run as a write-in candidate for U.S. Senate. Her campaign released a statement today saying she's not seeking the Libertarian Party's slot on the November ballot. The press release quotes Murkowski saying she believes during the primary the Alaska Republican Party was hijacked by the Tea Party Express, something she calls an outside extremist group. Murkowski is headed back to Washington right now. She plans to attend an Appropriations Committee markup on Thursday dealing with defense and other funding bills. She was noticeably absent from Washington today as Senate members met for their weekly party caucus lunches. After they meet behind closed doors, each party holds a press briefing. Over the past year, Murkowski has often been part of the star Republican team that addresses reporters since she's a member of their leadership ranks. This morning, the top Senate Republican, Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, threw his support behind the man who beat Murkowski in the Republican primary last month, Joe Miller. McConnell appeared on MSNBC and told reporter Chuck Todd that it's time for Murkowski to bow out.
I'm going to support Joe Miller. He won the primary fair and square. Senator Murkowski conceded the primary election.
Right.
It would be my hope, obviously, that she would accept that result and move on.
But have you reached out to her? Have you reached out to her and asked her not to?
I'm not going to talk about private conversations with Senator Murkowski. I talk to her frequently. I do all the time. She's been a member of our leadership team, and I, you know, have a good relationship with her. She knows that I'm supporting Joe Miller. I've contributed to Joe Miller. The National Republican Senatorial Committee is going to contribute to Joe Miller. We expect him to be the next senator from Alaska.
Senator McConnell has contributed $5,000 to Miller's campaign. Yesterday, a group of Republicans from Fairbanks wrote to McConnell looking for him to unequivocally support Miller and ask Murkowski to bow out. At the same time, Murkowski supporters have been urging her to get back in the race through a campaign on Facebook, as well as by contacting her campaign staff. Meanwhile, the race for the Senate seat isn't waiting for Murkowski to speak up. Joe Miller and Democratic candidate Scott McAdams both plan to be in Petersburg tomorrow for a meeting of the Southeast Conference. The two also will have their first public debate in Juneau on Thursday. How voters actually decide who will represent us at all levels of government has long been a mystery. Is it more from advertisements, endorsements, and bumper stickers, or from the candidate's direct contact with the public? A nonprofit organization that began 20 years ago is working to help voters make independent decisions on who best represents them. APRN's Dave Donaldson has more.
Project Vote Smart began as the result of a conversation between an unsuccessful candidate for the U.S. Senate, who called himself a liberal, and then U.S. Senator Barry Goldwater, the grandfather of modern conservative politics. That talk focused on how candidates spent more time creating an image than in addressing issues and the public's concerns. The nonprofit developed with the support and work of prominent people like Goldwater and George McGovern, Jimmy Carter and Gerald Ford. Additions to the board of directors are added in pairs from different sides of the political spectrum. It's run by people of different parties and philosophies who disagree on most issues except one. The people need to know who is on the ballot before they make their decisions. Through a staff consisting mostly of volunteers and interns, the organization accumulates biographical, financial, and public information on some 40,000 candidates nationwide. Then, they simply give it to the people, without comment or spin. Adelaide Kimball is a director and senior advisor to Project Vote Smart. She calls the group a library of factual information on incumbents and challengers, from presidential races to state legislative campaigns.
We focus on about six key components for each of these candidates: their voting records, their campaign contributions, their backgrounds, previous experience, their ratings by competing special interest groups, their speeches, public statements, and their issue positions through the political courage test, which we give every candidate running for those offices each election year.
The political courage test requires one thing. Candidates must show they're willing to tell voters how they'll handle issues. If they are, the test asks them a series of questions on subjects ranging from abortion to budget to crime to the environment. The questions are specific to state issues within those categories. For example, the Alaska questionnaire asks about use of the permanent fund earnings and the makeup of the state personnel board. Kimball says the group's researchers have gone through legislative debates, speeches, and platforms to determine what the candidates are concerned about. She says Project Vote Smart considers candidates as job applicants. They should show up with their resumes and talk about how they do the work at hand.
Increasingly, candidates are not willing to do that. They are clamming up. They are being advised by their party leaders, by their consultants, not to answer questions on issues if they can get around it. They're not willing anymore to expose themselves to their opponents in order to help voters figure out how they might handle these positions, so they're just not willing to talk about them.
Candidates' responses to the political courage test have been declining during the past few elections, and that decline has been bipartisan. Kimball says they're relying on canned messages or polling numbers rather than responding to voter interests. In Alaska, in 2006, 80% of the candidates responded. In 2008, it was only 25%. No endorsement, no campaign contributions are tied to the group. Kimball says there are no wrong answers to the test.
We bend over backwards to make sure that not only is there any bias or slant in VoteSmart's data, there's not even a perception of bias or slant in our data.
Information on the U.S. Senate and House candidates is now online at votesmart.org. Only Republican Joe Miller and Libertarian Frederick Hasse have responded so far. State candidates for governor and the legislature have just gotten their Alaska-specific tests, and those will be published next month. Voters can encourage them to share their opinions with the public through the website. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
As a disclosure, reporter Dave Donaldson has worked on other Vote Smart projects for about 10 years, advising them on their key votes reports. He reviewed the questions in this year's Political Courage Test. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, seismologists are keeping close watch on an Aleutians volcano.
Satellite images showed a weak plume, possibly containing ash, in the vicinity of Cleveland volcano.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Begin your UAF fisheries degree at any major University of Alaska campus and finish in Fairbanks or Juneau. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This week, shooting is scheduled to begin in Alaska on a major Hollywood film, Everybody Loves Whales. At yesterday's Anchorage Chamber of Commerce meeting, Alaskans in the film industry said more big screen productions are likely to follow. KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Mike Devlin, CEO of Evergreen Films, described what he sees as Alaska's newest big moneymaker to the Chamber's business audience.
Today, when you talk to anybody in Hollywood and you use the term Hollywood North, they think of Vancouver because there's a huge production industry in Vancouver. So our job is to change that so that when people say Hollywood North, they think of Alaska. And I think there's a great opportunity to do that.
Devlin said in 2008, the television and movie industry spent over $1 billion in British Columbia and supported some 20,000 jobs. Devlin was one of three panelists discussing what luring Hollywood productions to Alaska could mean. Besides Devlin, there was Carolyn Robinson, owner of Sprocket Heads, also of Anchorage, and Dave Worrell, manager of the state film office. In her talk, Robinson held up a film can and asked the audience to visualize a more familiar Alaskan symbol.
Think of this can of movie film as you would a barrel of oil.
Robinson explained.
On average, a feature film spends $100,000 per day. We can build a new kind of pipeline. In fact, those of us in the local film industry have already broken ground. But it is you and your people and your know-how and your ability to deliver goods and services that will weld and bolt this new economic pipeline.
Robinson played the final credits of a feature film on the chamber screen. She told the audience to think of those service credits as future business they might enjoy if a film company needed what the businesses could offer, whether it's catering, lodging, set building, transportation, and all the other needs required to shoot a film on location. Dave Worrell, manager of the State of Alaska Film Office, said besides the services local businesses offer, they can also give the out-of-state film production companies tax credit breaks. Under a new state incentive plan, the production companies receive a base tax credit when dealing with a local business, plus additional credits for hiring locally, filming in the off-season, and going to rural Alaska. Devlin, whose Evergreen Films is a production and studio company, says the credit system is crucial, but so is establishing an infrastructure and supplying Alaska expertise. That's why his company decided to invite Nana Development to become a one-third partner. NDC President and CEO Helvi Sandvig says her company and its subsidiaries bring to Evergreen a wide array of services.
We're in the logistics, we're in the catering, we're in the housekeeping, we're in facilities management business, but we also have a civil construction company, we have a structural construction company, we have engineering companies. We're a very diverse company.
Evergreen Films has invested over $10 million in its Alaska facility for 3D production and post-production technologies. It has completed or is working on 4 3D documentaries, plus concert films of the Dave Matthews Band and Fish. It's now trying to develop a television series based on Dana Stabenow's detective novels, Kate Shugak, Alaska PI. The state's biggest remaining problem to luring Hollywood to Alaska is its lack of sound stages. Robinson said there should be 4, and there currently are none. She suggested one possibility might be to convert existing warehouses. Robinson concluded by saying last Thursday she'd received confirmation that another Hollywood film company had chosen Alaska, with production beginning in early 2011.
I'm not yet at liberty to release most details of the project. However, I do have permission to let you know that discussions are underway with such leading male actors as Viggo Mortensen, Liam Neeson, and Oscar winner Jeff Bridges.
She added that Alaska was chosen after a worldwide location search. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Mount Cleveland showed more signs of activity last weekend. The volcano, located in the central Aleutians, has been fairly active this summer, and it released a 7-kilometer plume containing ash and steam on Sunday morning. Steve McNutt is a research professor at the University of Alaska Fairbanks and a coordinating scientist at the Alaska Volcano Observatory. Here's what he can make out from the satellite imagery of the volcano.
Satellite images showed a weak plume possibly containing ash in the vicinity of Cleveland volcano. And this is not completely in isolation. The remote sensing data from several different sensors has showed over the last couple of weeks an increase in the number of thermal anomalies. So that means when the satellites are flying straight overhead looking down in the volcano, they see evidence of increased heat in the summit area.
2 weeks ago, AVO placed Cleveland on watch and upped its status to yellow. But on Friday, AVO moved the volcano down to unassigned. Now it's back on yellow and will be for some time due to the difficulty of monitoring the volcano.
The trouble with Cleveland is it seems to be mildly active a lot of the time, and about a half dozen times a year it has these small eruptions, small to moderate eruptions with an ash plume up in the 15,000-20,000-foot range. And it's because we don't have any monitoring instruments directly on it, the best we can do is use the remote sensing data to try to guesstimate when the conditions are favorable.
Cleveland frequently emits ash, and plumes like this are released about 6 times a year. McNutt says that AVO is keeping a close eye on the volcano, but that increased thermal activity doesn't necessarily mean a major eruption is on the way. Still, even small plumes could spell trouble for air travel and inconvenience nearby boats. Trans-Pacific jets shouldn't be affected since they fly at much higher elevations.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
GrantStation, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
A professional adventurer has completed an over 4,700-mile trek around Alaska, the Yukon, and Northwest Territories. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, the 6-month journey spanned coastal, interior, and Arctic regions.
National Geographic-sponsored adventurer Andrew Skirka of Boulder, Colorado, completed the solo human-powered journey in Kotzebue last week, the same place he started back in March. The Grand Loop included skiing across the Alaska Range, hiking and pack rafting through the Wrangells and along the Gulf of Alaska, down the Yukon River and across the Brooks Range. The 29-year-old Skirka has no cause or scientific mission. He treks for the experience and says he was humbled by the North's vast wilderness.
There aren't many places where you can travel that far without crossing a road or where you don't come up on someone else. And the resulting sort of sense of exposure and vulnerability and sort of the anxiety that causes is pretty high, to say the least.
Skirka completed a 700-mile hike in Alaska last summer and has done numerous other epics in the lower 48. Skirka says this year's Alaska-Canada trip highlights included skiing west of Wonder Lake in the shadow of Denali last spring, and traveling the rugged Lost Coast from Yakutat to Gustavus this summer.
Beautiful beach walking, but then some really sort of dicey sections with really heavy bushwhacking near the Brady Glacier, and then some frightening looking river fords of the Grand Plateau Glacier, and you walk right across the terminal moraine of La Perouse Glacier. So some pretty wild stuff.
Skirka says his favorite part of the trip was hiking a remote stretch of the Brooks Range.
The one section that I'm sort of most proud of was the 650 miles between Fort McPherson, Northwest Territories, and Coldfoot. So 650 miles took me 3.5 weeks, and I didn't see another human being the entire time and never crossed a road.
Skirka says he resupplied along the way, but always lugged his own gear and followed a continuous backcountry route. He traveled very light, but carried a sat phone to check in with his mom and log online updates. Skirka says he held up physically and mentally to the trip's challenges, including weather, bugs, and wildlife encounters. He sought advice from Alaska adventurers, including Roman Dial of Anchorage, a veteran of numerous long backcountry treks. Dial says Skirka's trip is in a league by itself.
Linked together a lot of the classic routes that people have been traveling on for the last 20 years, but put them all together. I guess, honestly, it took me 30 years to cover that distance that he did in 6 months.
Dial says Skirka has the right mix of qualities for wilderness travel.
He's one of these guys who gets up in the morning and puts his shoes on and just walks all day until he goes to sleep at night. He'd make a really good sled dog in that he's got great feet and a good appetite. And he's also quite conservative. He's not a thrill seeker. So he's thoughtful about his river crossings, and he's thoughtful about his mountain crossings, and he looks and he's careful so he doesn't injure himself, which is the way a person has to be if you're going to be out there for 6 months at a time.
Dial says trips like Skirka's are as much an exploration of the human spirit as the landscape, and it's good for people to see that they can be done. Skirka says the trek has made him a better person and expects it won't be long before he pursues another big adventure. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
A false alarm earlier this month is prompting emergency rescue workers in Ketchikan to encourage aviators to inspect, maintain, and possibly replace their older emergency locator transmitter units. KRBD's Maria Dudzak reports.
In the early morning hours of September 2nd, the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad responded to a call from the U.S. Coast Guard Sector Juneau, the Rescue Coordination Center for Alaska. The Coast Guard reported that flight service in Ketchikan was hearing a signal just south of the Ketchikan Airport from an emergency locator transmitter, or ELT. Jerry Kiefer, incident commander of the Ketchikan Volunteer Rescue Squad, says a team responded to the call at about 3 o'clock Thursday morning.
The signal was really, really weak. I believe it may have been going off for quite some time. So it took a bit more time. I think we were 3 or 4 hours into actually tracking the signal down and located it on an aircraft that was over at the airport, on the ramp there at the airport. There was no emergency. It was just part of the problem of ELTs and the accidental activation and or failure of the unit that would cause them to activate.
Kiefer says the owners of the aircraft were contacted and the signal turned off. He says the aircraft had a 121.5 ELT. 121.5 is the frequency at which the ELT transmits. Kiefer says accidental activations and failures of that type of device are common. He says false alarms can be generated not only by ELTs, but other devices that transmit at the same frequency.
There are some fax machines, sometimes home audio systems will, you know, in combination with other signals within the home, will produce a 121.5 signal. That's not unheard of either. The failure rate for ELTs on 121.5 is pretty high.
Kiefer says the combination of signals from different devices can create false emergency alerts, leading to unnecessary search and rescue efforts. He says this, in part, led to the decision by the Coast Guard in 2009 to discontinue routine satellite monitoring of 121.5 ELTs. Kiefer says the Coast Guard recommends replacing older models with newer 406 megahertz devices. He says those units are being monitored by satellite, are more reliable than the 121.5 ELTs, and have a smaller chance of error.
The problem is, it depends on which unit you get. They started at around $1,000 plus installation, so they're very expensive in comparison to the older units. And I don't know anybody that's got them here in Ketchikan, frankly. I know maybe some of the air taxis have them. Certainly the Alaska Airlines does have them, but they're so expensive for general aviation, I think it's people are slow to buy them.
Kiefer says because of the cost and difficulty in acquiring the 406 ELTs, many pilots will continue to use the older 121.5 ELTs. He says pilots should be aware that those units may turn on accidentally and drain the battery. In Ketchikan, I'm Maria Dudzak.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Len Anderson in Anchorage, Alexandra Gutierrez in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Maria Dudzak in Ketchikan. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association, has been asked to administer the new temporary federal insurance program that allows individuals with a qualifying pre-existing condition and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months an opportunity to purchase health insurance. Capacity is limited, so contact an insurance broker or ACHEA immediately. More information at achia.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed. Working late? Hear Alaska News Nightly at any time of the day on the web at www.aprn.org.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.